Three, two, one. Isn't this fun? Okay. Well, thanks for coming today. I'm Patrick Maines, and it's my pleasure to have you and FCC Commissioner McDowell with us today. As you can see, we're going to conduct today's luncheon a little differently. Robert calls it a talk show format. But I think of it as something deeper than that, a kind of my dinner with Andre number. I didn't tell you that. Anyhow, it's very good to have you with us, Commissioner. Seems just like yesterday that we were all gathered at the Fairmont Hotel as you were given the Institute's Free Speech Award, presented to you by Rod Smola. I remember you telling me back then that Smola gave you an A- in a law school class that he taught, and that you'd always wondered about the minus part. So I decided to contact Rod to see if I could get an answer to that question, and I did. Here's what he said. I remember it well. Robert's grade was entirely undeserved, the minus, I mean. On the academic merits, the appropriate grade was clearly an A+. Yet even then, I could see that Robert was destined for great things. And as his professor and mentor, I was more interested in character than credentials. In short, I did it to keep him humble.
It worked. It worked. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Well, Robert and I have teed up a few subjects, about five or six, for discussion today. But before we get to any of the subjects, I'd like to tell you that that we're hoping, as Robert ends his comments about any given subject, that all of you will ask questions about the subject he's just discussed. If you'll just raise your hands, I'll recognize you, so far as you know. And we'll go from there. Well, Robert, I got to put my specs on here. I can't read this note. I got a quote here.
Discussion have footnotes involved?
It doesn't have footnotes. Let's see. Twice in the past 4 months, you've spoken of the threat posed to the internet by proposals being promoted by a coalition of countries within the ITU. You've said that these countries are, I quote, pushing hard for international regulation of the internet, close quotes. As I understand it, this matter will be on the agenda at the WCIT conference in Dubai in December. Strikes me that this is an important issue. And what you call the balkanization of the internet is a thing of great importance, even as it's gotten little play, relatively little play here in the United States. So a few questions that present themselves. What are the specific threats? Which countries are proposing them, and why?
So the threats are actually very broad, and it's very real. Now, just to give a little bit of context, this has gone on for years, this sort of thing, when the ITU, some member states of the ITU, have looked for more power for the ITU in the realm of internet governance. And historically, the United States or the UK or some other countries have been able to sort of table motions and such through parliamentary maneuvers or have it done for further study. But this time seems different. And this actually, my concern came from a meeting I had in Brussels back in November. And after that meeting, I made some phone calls around the internet governance space, sort of outside of the core constituency of the FCC. And sure enough, folks at all levels, whether it's the nonprofit, non-governmental internet governance groups, such as the Internet Society, or the Public Interest Registry, they're the folks who administer the .org domain name, as well as carriers and content and application providers, pretty much uniformly across the board, we're very concerned that there's a new energy and a new organization by countries, certainly such as Russia and China for the bigger name countries, but also Iran, some in sub-Saharan Africa, and others throughout the world to do this. And I think for a variety of reasons. One is the ITU just wants more authority, wants to continue to be relevant. It's a 147-year-old organization at this point, so it actually predates the UN, even though it's an arm of the UN, and wants relevance as the technology marches on. But also, I think the internet space, if you will, is seen as dominated by the US, whether it's, for instance, Google or Facebook or the long-haul pipes of AT&T or whomever, as well as the fact that ICANN at one point had more of a more control by the U.S. government, since it's been spun off. And that there's the concern that this is all U.S.-dominated and somehow the developing world in particular must wrest control, and countries like China and Russia can take advantage of such a rhetoric, whether or not that's grounded in reality or not. So the ITU has about 193 member states in it. There are a series of meetings between now and December, which is when this culminates for this round, with the next sort of big inflection point being June, with a bunch of working groups. The ITU divides itself into six regions throughout the world. So a number of concerns. First of all, that industry was afraid but not organized. And so I've urged them several times to organize themselves. But it can't be seen as a U.S. versus developing world issue. Actually, an unfettered internet, and this is the speech I gave in Barcelona at the GSMA Association's World Congress there, the developing world stands to benefit the most from an unfettered internet. So it would be tragic for there to be some sort of centralized control of these issues, which happen more quickly through the multi-stakeholder, what we call the multi-stakeholder model. It would start to undermine the growth of the internet, the flow of investment capital, economic growth, and political freedom throughout the world. But realistically, what it would probably just do is create uncertainty and confusion. I mean, countries, hopefully, like the U.S., would not participate under such a regime. And then you might have U.S. companies, whether they're over-the-top application and content providers or not, just opting out of doing business in certain parts of the world. So it has the potential effect for cybersecurity, privacy, standard setting, domain name administration, a whole host of things to be taken away from the multi-stakeholder process and put under ITU control. So whether you're selling consumer electronics or if you're selling space on your pipes through peering arrangements or whatever, all of that is at risk, and it can create confusion in a marketplace that has been benefiting the world economically and politically since it spun further away from government control back in the mid-90s.
Of the ITU countries, how many are behind this effort?
Well, it's hard to get a whip count, but by some estimates of people who are more of an expert in this area than I am, it could be close to 90 countries. 97 needed for
that
majority.
Many?
Pardon?
That
90,
many?
9-0, yeah. So if 97 is needed for majority, granted the ITU doesn't just work on majority rules, but you're getting to a tipping point here, and that causes great concern.
You know, I happen to have a copy of your speech in Barcelona, and it's arresting. Can I just read part of it?
Sure. We're all about the freedom of speech here.
Institute, so. Some of us are. While we are enjoying the Mobile World Congress here in Barcelona, 624 kilometers away in Geneva, the ITU's member states are convening to take the ITR negotiations a step further in this diplomatic journey toward Dubai. We're at a crossroads for the internet's future. One path holds great promise, while the other path is fraught with peril. Sounds pretty serious. I'm still not quite sure I understand exactly why these 90 countries are pushing for this.
So I think it's a mix of things. So there's the.
I mean, I understand what you think is the threat of it, but why do they want to do it?
Yeah. So again, a mix of things. There's the political sort of anti-Americanism, I think, is part of it. In all honesty, But also economically, I think local phone companies, some of which are state-owned, see an opportunity to charge over-the-top providers for traffic that is, in their view, dumped on their networks without, in their view, the ability to compensate for it. And you know, there's an important note there. I'm all for pricing freedom. The more a consumer uses in terms of bandwidth, the more a network operator ought to be able to allow, ought to be allowed to charge more for that bandwidth. But I think that is enticing, and what they're not really understanding is that it's going to really snuff out the potential for over-the-top content and applications in their own countries. If all you really, the barriers of entry for development of such an industry are extremely low. If all you really need is a laptop to get started and you're writing software, if kids in their dorm room can start a Google or a Facebook, that means someone in the developing world can as well. But if you start raising the economic costs of that type of business, that will start to snuff out any potential hope of economic development in those countries, in that space.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Russia and China. Are Brazil and India, what's their posture?
Yeah, and Brazil and India are a part of it as well. And in some countries, you might have a division, a difference of opinion between, let's say, the Ministry of the Foreign Ministry and the Ministry of IT, if there is one, or a telecoms minister. But India went so far at one point to propose a resolution at the UN for the creation of a new body, separate from the ITU, to be just the internet regulator internationally.
Right.
India has taken some steps back from that, but we're not quite sure exactly what that means just yet. And you know, pretty much an exact quote from Vladimir Putin is that I think this is a quote, we need international control of the internet through the ITU.
Any questions for the commissioner about this subject? Yes.
Excellent question. So I think, you know, one of my concerns is that what could result at the end of this is a compromise that gives the ITU jurisdiction through, let's say, a definitional change, small, seemingly innocuous definitional change, but huge in scope and potential for where things could go. And if you look, for instance, at the Arab states proposal, so the Arab states is the one of the six regions that the ITU divides itself into. It calls for just that. That came out on February the 1st. So it could be offered up under any number of reasons, which again seem harmless at the time. But down the road, you know, it's the planting of a seed that really could grow into Jack's beanstalk very quickly within, you know, a couple of years. So, you know, December in Dubai is sort of one stop on this road, but it's not going to end there. There are other meetings, you know, on the march down the road. You know, 2015 is another big inflection point, for instance. So, you know, it's hard again to get a firm sort of whip count on which country is doing what. There are certainly leaders in this space, and so trying to follow who their natural constituencies might be, their normal partners or client states in the case of China and Russia. China with tremendous reach into Africa, for instance. Russia with some of its old client states able to bring some votes to the table, et cetera. So really the mission, I think, has to be to engage with countries throughout the world, but especially the developing world, so that it bubbles up from within those countries to their home governments the message of how this actually could be detrimental to their home economies.
Any other questions? Yes.
So, substantively, the administration is, we're all on the same note. You've got U.S. industry, I think, all on the same side as well. We're getting hand signals. This is like the coach with a... Oh, repeat the question. What was the question?
I didn't ask the question. It was right here. I didn't hear.
So my assessment of the administration's response. So let me see if I'm going to be consistent with where I was a minute ago. So far, substantively, we're all on the same side. In industry within the U.S. is on the same side. So it's interesting when you pull together a meeting, you have AT&T and Google shaking hands over this. So that's great. Kumbaya. I have expressed concern that we don't have yet a named head of delegation for this. I understand that that's being pursued at the administration, but substantively, we're all on the same side of this.
Yes, any other questions? Okay, Gary.
Everybody can hear Gary, though, right? So I don't need to repeat. So absolutely, there's some nationalism involved. There are a variety of motivations, I think, to answer your question, I think Lynn's as well. Yes, we have a very good team at the State Department. The State Department takes the lead on these things. It's a treaty negotiation, after all. And there's some excellent people from Ambassador Phil Revere, from the Secretary of State, who's very involved with the internet freedom issues as well. To Ambassador Phil Revere and others in the career shop there. So I'm just a bit anxious that we seem to be slower moving on this one than we have been on other similar fights over the years.
Any more before we go to the next subject? No, I guess not. Speaking before the PLI and the FCBA in February, you talked at length about the spectrum auctions that Congress had then just passed. And you said this, I quote, "Before the ink on the new law has even dried, however, a debate has escalated over whether or how the government should shape the outcome of this upcoming 700 megahertz auction. Time and again, history has proven that regulators' attempts to over-engineer spectrum auctions result in harmful, unintended consequences," close quote. I wonder if you'd care to expand on that and on which prospective regulations concern you most.
Well, just having gone through two large auctions since I've been at the commission since 06, so the AWS auctions of 06 and the 700 megahertz auction of 08. So first of all, these things can take time and can take a lot longer than you think at first. Congress should be commended for passing the legislation that it did and the president for signing it. This will spark the most complicated spectrum auction in world history. That's not an overstatement to say that. But when you're talking about trying to give broadcasters an incentive and who might participate and how that affects table allotments and things like that, that's going to cause a lot of complications. But what we need to avoid, and I commend the chairman in his public dialogue of late, Chairman Jenikowski, for talking more and more about the need to have flexible uses of spectrum. And in my view of that, that means spectrum that's as unencumbered as possible with conditions, because frequently when government tries to micromanage to say a particular frequency is going to be used for a particular purpose and not something else, by the time that actually gets out into the marketplace, sometimes innovation has passed the government's best intentions by, and then the FCC has to go back to another rulemaking, and that can take up a lot of needless time. In the meantime, that spectrum lies fallow or isn't used in its highest and best to its highest and best potential. So I learned a lot from the 700 megahertz auction vote in July of 07. I dissented in part to the conditions on the C block. I also would have preferred a different band plan that's spectrum block sizes and geographic sizes of licenses and such. But if you think about all the headlines walking into that vote in July of 07, is that we had Google, the presumed new entrant into the wireless space, that the C block had to be engineered for their purposes. The band plan was being sold as allowing for more small entities to be successful in the auction, and a number of other goals. And what actually ended up happening was Google didn't bid on the C block. Verizon did for 77 cents per megahertz pop in comparison to the A and the B blocks. That was about, the C block was about a third of the price of the A and the B blocks. So what that did was it drove deeper pocketed bidders into the A and the B blocks and forced out small businesses from being able to participate. So the ostensible goals of the government trying to create this sort of Rube Goldberg scenario backfired and had the opposite effect, actually, and also probably reduced some revenue to the Treasury as well, which that is part of Congress's intent when they auction spectrum. So let's try to avoid that. Let's learn from our mistakes, and let's certainly not try to engineer spectrum blocks for a particular business plan.
Questions? Yes.
So I think, excellent question, thank you, Brooks. So I think we can have, well, first of all, first things first, which is we have to find out from broadcasters who's actually interested, right? And that's gonna be a hard part. So Dennis, yeah, you wanna chime in there? And that's important, and that's gonna affect things like the table of allotments. Now, I know it makes a really exciting lunch when you use terms like table of allotments, but do we have extra coffee to go around, some espresso? But it's actually very important, and there's a domino effect across the nation, certainly in the most populated parts of the country, as to if broadcaster A is participating in market number one, and how does that affect repacking and all the rest, and who's going to be where on the dime. Consumers are ultimately affected. So step number one, we have to find out which broadcasters are interested in at what price. Once we finally get to an auction, so we're skipping over a lot of steps here, but the band plan, I would hope, would have a place for large carriers, mid-sized carriers, and smaller carriers, and new entrants. And I think there's a way to do that without having to exclude any party from an auction, and I'm concerned about that. And then in the course of all that, too, which is what will be the encumbrances, the conditions, if any, on that spectrum. I would hope it'd be minimal, and again, thank the chairman, Chairman Jenikowski, for recently having spoken about flexible uses. So then we go to auction, but I think, Brooks, you'll be writing about this for a long time. So this is full employment for reporters on this subject and lawyers in this space. Yep, that's right, we need more. Because these things always do take longer than expected, and I don't want to be a wet blanket on what is otherwise a positive and constructive piece of legislation. But if you look at the 700 megahertz auction, really it all started with a congressional act going back to 1997. And there was the DTV Act of 2005, which actually passed in 2006. Someone forgot to update the name of the law. And then there was more legislation on that, extending the DTV deadline, of course. So. These things can take a long time, and let's try to get it right, of course, but let's also keep in mind that we need to all be patient.
Any other questions about spectrum? Yes, Eddie.
So if you are a broadcaster and you're spending on the sidelines watching the legislation and the activities of the FCC, and the question would be, I might be interested, but at what price and what percentage
signature's barely dry on the legislation, Eddie, so I'm sure we'll get around to that. But, that's obviously very important, and it's not just a good idea, but it's the law. So I'm sure we'll be working on that as soon as possible.
Any other questions about, yes, Mona.
Increasing
Right, and as you point out, so everyone heard that? Leasing of TV spectrum, it is currently allowed by law and has been since before the legislation. Is it Section 336, I believe? It wasn't you, okay. He's been talking to his lawyers a lot, I guess. It wasn't me. So I have talked about it as an alternative. I think that idea has obviously been overshadowed by the legislation, and so first things first would be to implement that legislation as best we can and as quickly as we can. But it is hanging out there as something I think that could be attractive to a lot of broadcasters. I think we could, certainly once we start opening up proceedings for public comment, I would want public TV stations and anyone else who's interested to put their ideas of, could this be somehow incorporated as we are reconfiguring the table of allotments. There it is again. Maybe we should all like drink once every time I say table of allotments. That would make it more exciting. So water, though, just water or coffee. But maybe we could incorporate that or not. I don't know. It's certainly interesting food for thought, because repacking is a big part. To make it more attractive for wireless companies, you just don't want 3 megahertz there and 3 megahertz way over here. You want large contiguous blocks if possible. So how can we go about doing that? So that would add a degree of difficulty. Bill Lake, where are you? So we're making your job more difficult as we go.
It's difficult enough already.
Thank you. Right, that's right. Yeah, I would hope, absolutely. So give us your ideas.
But not this minute.
No, sure.
I guess we take one more question if it's a short one about this particular subject. Yes.
Sure. Hi, anything you want to say about the release of this spectrum allotment optimization model?
Bill, do you want to comment on that? I'll put you on the spot.
Sure,
he loves that. He's going to love me now.
Bill, actually, I hope you won't. I should have announced this earlier. Bill's actually going to be the Media Institute's next luncheon speaker in April. So
all right.
Maybe we can save it.
Saved by Patrick. So you can't write that story just yet. I'm sorry, John. Everyone's got their plug in today.
Online political files are another controversial subject. It's my understanding that broadcasters have been most concerned about having to put their ad rates online, and also by the cost and logistics and having to maintain the file. But that now comes a proposal from the TV Operators Caucus that they say would give journalists and the public what they want most from broadcasters without some of the onerous requirements. I wonder if you could elaborate on this matter.
Sure. So, first of all, transparency is important, especially in the world of campaign finance and campaign spending. The political file issue is an interesting one. TV broadcasters are required to maintain the political file, and I think most people in the room know what we're talking about here. The FCC has rules that have been on its books for decades, but also with the McCain-Feingold bill, I think it's Section 504 of that bill, of that law, required that broadcasters also keep it. So the FCC was incorporated into that legislation. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that if there have to be files, it should be done in the cheapest way. If it's for public disclosure, you would think that online would work in all cases. In 2007, we looked at this issue for the public inspection files to place them online and decided that most of them should be kept online, but the political file actually presented a unique set of facts, one of which is the cost of maintaining that. The sensitive information regarding rates, advertising rates. So federal candidates for federal office are entitled to the cheapest rates. One former senator said it's food stamps for politicians. I won't say who that was. So this is an entitlement basically to the lowest rate. But that is competitive information. So The delicate thing here that where I think we really need to be very deliberative, we have to follow the statute. Broadcasters have to maintain these files. But we want to make sure that we're not actually increasing costs for broadcasters and that we're not requiring them to disclose sensitive pricing information, which could, that disclosure could then result in unintended consequences, such as price signaling by broadcasters or just the revelation of sensitive information, which other industries don't have to do. And then in my testimony last week before the House Appropriations Subcommittee, I wanted to start sort of a larger discussion, conversation about, is this the best way to be monitoring campaign spending? And are we the agency to do this? So TV broadcasters are one of many, many recipients of campaign dollars, either from a campaign or from a committee or from a super PAC. Right, so there are a lot of ways to get messages out to voters to persuade them and to get them to the polls. And this burden seems to be falling disproportionately upon TV broadcasters. So should we sort of turn the microscope around a little bit or look through the other end of it and have the Federal Election Commission, which this is their job, look at perhaps whether this should be examined from committees that collect the money and spend the money, rather than one out of many recipients of it. So I think there are a number of complex issues here. There are a lot of nuances. There's a lot of potential costs to be borne by one small segment of what becomes sort of the campaign finance ecosystem. And I think we need to be very careful and thoughtful and deliberate.
Is there a split in this between the Operators Caucus and the rest of the broadcasters?
They're probably, I don't know what all the different broadcaster opinions might be on all this, because there's certainly some represented by, they divide up into all sorts of different groups, different affiliates and different interests, public, private, all the rest. So.
All right. You know what? I'm going to violate the rule that I set down at the outset because we're running out of time, and I've got about three other subjects here to get to briefly. So if you'll hold your questions until we're done with this, you'll get time to talk then about, or ask then about anything we've talked about earlier. The Supreme Court decision in FCC versus Fox News should be coming down this summer. And I was wondering if you had any wishes or predictions about how that case will be resolved.
I hope it is consistent with the First Amendment.
Perfect.
FCC has had its official say in court, but I will welcome the guidance. Either way, I think this is the first case in maybe a generation that sheds a lot of light on what the parameters are for the commission. It will give a lot of clarity. We have about 1.5 million indecency complaints pending at the commission based on just under 10,000 broadcasts, we need to, I've been saying for years, we need to get those moving. The oldest dates back to 2003. I literally have children who are older than the complaints that have been sitting there. So we need to get moving with it, and I welcome a decision from the Supreme Court any day now. So it can happen any day now.
For most of the time that I've been involved with the Media Institute, media ownership has been a big issue. But the question I have now is, does anybody want to buy anything?
You're asking me that?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
So maybe you should ask the crowd that.
It used to be a hot issue with the broadcasters and the newspapers. And I don't know. Is it still?
There's a lot of issues are there. I expressed some concern when we voted out our NPRM last year about whether or not we're just adopting the status quo. We've had the status quo for a very long time. The marketplace has been passing us by very quickly. Consumers consume their information and entertainment from so many different portals than we could have imagined 25 years ago. So let's get on with maybe modernizing our rules. And one of the more vexing rules for me is newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. Now, as a broadcaster, you are allowed to push your content out through a number of portals. It could be radio, it could be TV, it could be the internet. It could be outdoor advertising, skywriting, could be anything. But for some reason, the government says that if you push your content out on a piece of paper, that this is very dangerous. This is very dangerous for you to be able to do this. Others say, just as you implied, well, the marketplace has passed it by. Why does it matter anymore? And that's actually kind of part of my point, which is I think we need to really examine this in a much more fundamental way. Section 202H, which was codified in 1996 under the 1996 Act, actually compels the commission to deregulate as more competition comes into the market. Mm. And I think we certainly have much more competition in the media marketplace than we did in 1996. So that should be the slant, the angle from which the commission approaches media ownership.
You've expressed the hope that the FCC might someday issue its annual video competition report, given that the last one issued in 2009 was for industry data from 2006. I used to recall reading these things back when I think it was Bob Pepper was in charge, and as I recall, they weren't always correct in their forecasts, but they were always interesting and full of useful data. So I'm not quite sure how to ask this question since you are the FCC, but why hasn't the FCC released one of these annual reports?
I don't know. There must be a legislative interpretation that A, Pluto is still a planet, and B, they meant Plutonian years and not Earth years.
That was. So.
Okay. Other than that, I don't know. I can't help you as to why.
Gary.
No idea. Gary Shapiro, two unrelated questions. You can answer one about another. First of all, Senator DeMint has introduced legislation which would eliminate all broadcasting from the election. I'd like to know if you're using that. And second, a bigger question, just to look back a second. The AT&T T-Mobile, one sentence from the chairman cost like $4 billion.
So, first with the DeMint legislation, you've heard me say this before, is that I don't tell Congress what to do, they tell me what to do, so I know. Yeah. So it's only when they really drag me before them at a hearing and they ask me point blank, you know, yes or no questions from John Dingell or someone like that. So will I really give an answer? So, yes. I noticed that. And then, you know, your other question is a complex one. I mean, there's always regulatory risk, and as a substantive matter, you know, as a commissioner, the issue of that transaction didn't come before me, so it wasn't presented to us. So we didn't have until the public saw that memo posted. That was the first time I was able to see it as well. But in terms of the entire sort of raw record, we never went through in my office the due diligence we should have if we were going to have a vote, because there was never a vote teed up for us. So it's hard to comment on all the substance, but as a procedural matter or a more theoretical matter from a higher altitude. Oh, well, then you have to go to Congress. That's an easy question. So. Back at you.
Other questions? Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So I'm going to piggyback on Gary. Oh.
Well, so it actually is before the commission. You're saying it's not up to the floor. So it's a pending transaction matter. I don't comment on pending transaction matters. So, sorry.
Yeah.
Adonis.
What's the latest development? What's the latest development? What do you see going forward that will allow new areas to enter?
So, and first of all, for those who aren't familiar, I believe you're referring to the 2007 order on no urban, no Hispanic dictates and banning those, which it ends up, we didn't know at the time, was the first federal civil rights rule adopted in about 25 years, I think, at that time. And estimates at the time were that could have helped stimulate a flow of dollars, advertising dollars, of north of $100 million a year to minority owned broadcasting entities. So it was a no-brainer to do at the time, and I was appalled that such things were allowed prior to that vote. And going forward, I think there's a lot of great hope and promise. Part of the spectrum legislation, part of the big upside is that it allows us to also get on with our work for unlicensed use of the TV white spaces. So chip designers actually have had to just put on hold all efforts to design their chips because they weren't quite sure where white spaces would be, et cetera, until that legislation passed and we implement it. So I think the greatest promise is where are the eyeballs and advertising dollars going, and that's going to be new media, and that's where there are the lowest barriers of entry. There aren't legacy rules there. It's a wild frontier in a lot of ways. So I think that's very, very encouraging, and I think there are a lot of success stories for minority-owned and women-owned and small businesses and historically disadvantaged businesses in that space. In the meantime, we have tried to do some things in the traditional space. We just put out our order on low-power FM pursuant to the legislation, and I want to thank the Bureau for all their hard work, and I know Bill Lake and Peter Doyle worked very, very long hours on that, as did all the offices on the eighth floor. So there's some hope there, because that tried to balance LPFM stations with FM translators and the whole AM world as well, and there are a lot of minority-owned businesses there. So I think there's great hope and promise, but I would, if I were in that space, if I were allowed to go in that space, I would go more in the new media space and try to have some good business plans drawn up for unlicensed use of TV white spaces.
We have time for one more question. Anybody?
I don't care anymore. Sorry.
Commissioner, thank you so much for being with us today.